Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. India, it's been said, is a noisier version of the United States. You can pick up a bit of that noise right here, this radio hour, the sound of suffering and dismay in COVID-stricken India, cases spiking straight up in a country that thought it had licked the virus for the world. Here's a sample of the talk of India this week.
There are children who have lost both parents in 48 hours. And because it's a COVID household, there's no one to take that child.
Wow.
It's out of some dystopian, bad movie. I never thought I'd see this in the country.
Abhinandan Sekri is an educated podcaster in New Delhi. We think of him and his media laundry as a counterpart to our own free-ranging open-source conversation. So we asked Abhinandan, who's known as Abhi, to keynote our take on India's catastrophe. Abhi caught the virus himself and got over it. One of his right-hand editors just died of it. COVID is present in India, as it is not in the U.S., in the smell and falling ash of dead bodies burning in the Hindu ritual of open-air cremation. There's not a soul in all of India, Abhi says, that hasn't witnessed the driven desperation of families hoping to save a life. He sees himself as a man without influence, and still his phone rings nonstop.
So right now we're in the worst crisis ever that I have seen in my living memory. And people way older than me in their 60s and 70s who have seen a really poor, poverty-stricken India tell me the same thing, that they haven't seen anything so bad. The way the hospitals are completely overrun and crematoriums, cremation grounds, because the majority population of India is Hindu and Hindus cremate their dead. So much smoke in one part of Delhi a few days ago, because there were like 30 or 40 bodies being burnt from morning to evening. And the famous photograph, which caused much offense to the establishment and the establishment journalists in India, was the New York Times photograph. It was a crematorium which had 45 pyres burning at the same time or thereabouts.
And now Arundhati Roy says crematoriums in Delhi have run out of firewood.
Yes, that did happen. In fact, there was one electric crematorium in one city in Gujarat. It was burning nonstop for so long that its main burner, it's made of iron in the furnace, it melted.
Mm.
To give you an idea what it's like, Chris, I run a very small news operation, and you have met most members of my team when you were here a couple of years ago. They're young journalists, and we've had about six of them hit by COVID. My editor were also hit by COVID, but luckily we had relatively a milder case. My wonderful, warm, affectionate gentleman of a desk editor, Ashish Yashuri, passed. He was only 35 years old.
Oh, my.
He was in the ICU for almost 14 days. And it was heartbreaking and tragic. And it was tough for the team. But, you know, you've been to India. Privilege makes a huge difference. Who you know, how high profile you are, who you have access to, who will take your call. Chris, in the last 14 days, probably longer, I get a minimum of 10 calls or texts every day of people just wanting to get a bed. Can you help me? Do you know anyone? You know so-and-so. Can you please get us a bed? But even when you're talking to someone at the hospital, the background noise that you hear, the hysterical screams of people who are just in parking lots, who are left with no oxygen, it seems like a bad disaster movie. And I would never have imagined in my wildest dreams that I would see an India like this. There doesn't seem to be any command center who is deciding how are we going to cope with this. I mean, we hear stories on a daily basis of...
Let me just say, this is pretty basic stuff. Oxygen, bottled oxygen.
Yes, it's at a huge premium. There's a black market that is mushroomed because there just isn't enough oxygen to go around. And what is tragic is that we had a year to prepare. I understand that one can't ramp up the healthcare of a country as large as India in a year. But surely one can take care of oxygen, because so many deaths are happening because people are not getting enough oxygen. Just today, there's a story in Scroll, which is a very good news platform, which talks about aid that has been sent from the world over, which is lying at the Delhi airport for the last 3 days. But there is no command center to tell any state, where does this have to go? How does it have to be rationed? And I'm not just talking about small government hospitals that are running short of medicines. Large hospitals that are considered the luxurious hospitals of Delhi, they are running short. We had, in the last month, over 20 deaths because of oxygen shortage in Delhi. Today in Karnataka, we had over 20. And I'm seriously telling you, Chris, I mean, I don't have any kids of my own, but I have nieces and nephews. I'm wondering, should I make sure that my nieces and nephews leave this country? And there are so many like me who would never have imagined thinking this way in our lifetimes.
Abhi, tell us the story of your colleague, Ashish Yashuri. I'm sure I met him. Did he ever know where he got the virus? Did he feel he had a fighting chance at any point once it struck?
Chris, I don't know of a single family that doesn't have someone who has not had COVID. When your positivity rate is 30%, and that too when most people can't get a test done in the city, who's to say where you got it? I mean, I got tested because my mother got fever one day. So I said, everybody gets tested. And everybody was positive, but she's the only one who had fever. So had she not had fever, I wouldn't have known either, right?
What treatment did Ashish get?
Chris, he actually got this, I'd say, a week before the numbers started going through the roof here in Delhi and the northern part of India. Luckily, he got a bed at the time and he got really good medical care. But he battled for 2 weeks, and then in the one morning I was told that he's no more. But I will tell you this, Chris, I know so many people who have not been able to get a hospital room. I know so many people who have had to run all over the place trying to get oxygen and just about getting enough to last a night. By the second half of the second week of April, the numbers had gone so high that no matter how connected you are, getting a bed was a struggle. It was a nightmare, and it still is.
Abhi, so many people from India are writing about a collapse of governance. And when you have 300 tons of aid just sitting there at the airport, or when you can't get oxygen for the life of you, that's collapse of governance. How do people explain it? And how do they deal? Is there anybody to complain to? Is there any political hope?
Well, one can only get an explanation if we have someone who takes questions, and we don't. Now, let me just read this headline to you. It's, where are the 300 tons of emergency COVID-19 supplies that have landed in Delhi in the last 5 days? And the blurb is, no domestic flights have taken off to carry the supplies to other parts of India, nor have states been informed about their share by the center. Now, when you say, who's in charge of deploying all the resources that have been sent our way? The question is, who do you ask? So the Delhi High Court has been hearing this case for the last 4 days, dealing with the COVID emergency. And the attorney who is representing the government of India has said that the Prime Minister and the Home Minister are personally overseeing the deployment of oxygen. But neither of them is available for comment. Neither of them takes any press conference. Neither of them takes any questions. And at a time like this, you need a vigilant media that asks tough questions of its government. And because over the last 6 years, the collapse of legacy media's independence has been so absolute, and they are such servile cheerleaders, this government has taken for granted they will not be asked any questions. You know, I could just go on talking for 5 hours. It's not going to serve any purpose. But the blatant and obvious demonstrations of misgovernance and callousness is mind-boggling.
This is the social and kind of emotional.
I'm sorry. Hello? But he will need a ventilator. But the thing is, the bed hasn't come through over there. That's the problem.
Are we there, Abhi?
Just 1 second, yeah. I'm so sorry about this. Can you just stop?
Okay.
There's this friend doesn't have a bed and his oxygen levels are falling.
Okay, we'll stand by.
I'll just have a chat. Okay, bye. Sorry, Chris.
Are we back?
Yeah.
Abhinandan, there's a feeling dimension of this thing that I wasn't ready for, but Arundhati Roy wrote beautifully about it the other day. She said, there is only a heart-shaped hole filled with cold indifference where India's public heart should be. Something's dropped out of human caring in this moment, in this society, it sounds like.
Yeah, you know what I see is the stakes of governance are so high that lives are often not that important. What really rocks my world, or what I see around, is that much of what is happening doesn't have any winners, you know, no potential upside. It just makes you wonder. And a part of our society has got desensitized at a level where they will defend the indefensible.
Is there a way back, Abhi?
The one thing that we can learn from this is that without a robust healthcare mechanism where we value the lives of our countrymen and countrywomen, the chest thumping and the cliches of the next superpower, of leading the world, is just hollow talk. It is the empty boasts of a provincial bully. Every person in this country has either experienced it within one's extended family or in the neighbor's extended family. Nobody in this country, I can say with full confidence, has not witnessed the really craven desperation of your friends or family or relatives trying to save someone's life. And I think this is a moment where we can correct our moral compass and say, you know what? Lives of people matter. You cannot have people begging to let their families into a hospital and just having to see them die in parking lots.
Abhinandan, this is shocking and important. And your independent voice in a stacked media is more important than ever. Keep doing what you're doing. You're strong in spirit, and you're a wonderful public voice.
Thank you, Chris, and it's always a pleasure speaking to you. I do wish we speak again in better times when we've all learned something from a disaster so horrific.
Coming up, the history behind a healthcare system that seems designed to be inadequate in a national crisis. This is Open Source. Kavita Sivaramakrishnan is a public health historian who speaks of the COVID crisis in India as a perfect storm that didn't blow up overnight.
So what we see today is a middle class, an elite, that thought that this kind of a system, a public health system that has been privatized, where the state has really retrenched its resources from the public, would be the sort of system if they had the resources that they would have access to. And what we see in the second wave of the pandemic is really that they're not able to access the system anymore in Delhi, partly because the system just can't cope. I think hospitals have become really zones of abandonment, where the private healthcare system, which was never supposed to cope at the time of a crisis, it was basically a system where you would pay your way to get super specialized care. It was not supposed to be meant for a pandemic.
It's so interesting, and it rhymes with what we've been hearing. There's also, if I'm not mistaken, a kind of hardening of the heart around the whole system. People know they're stuck, and there's nothing to be done.
What COVID has really taught us in some ways is that we have a state which either has been very, very interventionist, as we know, when we've had lockdowns and other things, or we've had a state that's completely retreated. What we see now in the second wave is a retreat of the state. So we see this real kind of contradiction between a state that lacks an empathy, but is really top down. And it either chooses to intervene very closely and regulate, or it chooses to retreat from any kind of compassion, from empathy, and from really being able to relate to needs at a local level immediately now that there's a crisis.
You've said it's a perfect storm, but it didn't happen overnight. What are the roots of this very ambivalent, strange, contradictory situation?
This is the perfect storm, which represents the downside of a privatized public health system, especially in Delhi. It's not the same thing in other parts of India, because you have a public that's been used to certain kinds of favoritism and access. And it goes back to the 1980s and 90s when India opened up a public health system which was quite underinvested. We had a focus already on tertiary care rather than primary care. And then what happened is a range of big development projects, the kinds of projects that Prime Minister Nehru and others had conceived of in the 1950s and 60s, which was to really build a cadre through economic planning, a cadre of health workers at the primary level, people who would volunteer community workers. All of those programs really had a setback in the 1980s and 90s, and it was decided that there would be public-private partnerships in health. So what you had was a certain section of the population that had access to these kind of new facilities that came up, and a poorer population that did not. And that was a trade-off that was okay for India's middle classes, because many of them felt that if you could pull yourself up from the bootstraps, that if you're worthy and hardworking, then you will get what you deserve, which is really access to this healthcare. And what's happened now is you see that unless there's a collective investment, unless there is basically the state investing in public infrastructure, the private infrastructure, and a lack of central coordination will just not suffice during a crisis.
Kavita, may I ask, who spoke for the working class? The unorganized poor of India, a vast majority in that deal, that switch?
Well, no one did really, but that's because over many decades, the sorts of paternalistic schemes that existed in the 1950s and 60s of India's vision of thinking of these big factories, of setting up industrial zones, which were partly assisted by the US, partly by the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And in that kind of a notion of capitalism, you had the welfare of workers, which was paternalistic. You had clinics for workers for infectious diseases to make sure they were productive, that you had a labor force that went to work. But what happened gradually was really a withdrawal from offering that kind of care to the working class. And I've worked on the influenza pandemic of 1957-58. What's remarkable is that the government, the Indian government, a newly independent Indian government, is not worried really about the number of deaths. What they really are worried about is labor absenteeism, the lack of productivity amongst workers. But they are still able to offer care in cities like Calcutta and cities like Bombay to cotton workers, to jute workers. And all of that really gets retrenched and withdrawn increasingly in the 1980s under the illusion of a new kind of pact, right? A social pact where borders are liberalized, where investment is opened up, and where it's assumed that everyone will get a job and there'll be opportunities. And a range of experts as well as politicians were all complicit in thinking that this was the way out. And it was the way out when you think of these big specialty hospitals, but for a very, very narrow group of people, of a certain class of people who had access to this kind of care. So there was a neglect at the bottom, and there was a neglect in the middle with an elite having access. And what we see now in this perfect storm in the second wave is that actually that the kind of dream or hubris that they bought into doesn't exist. It's a dream of access and mobility that during a crisis has completely faded away. The panic is partly the panic of a pandemic, but I think it's also the panic of knowing that this has been a storm that's been long in the making.
You know, I almost remember that period of mid-Nehru in the 50s and 60s, in which American universities, MIT among them, played a big part in building infrastructure for industry, science, the future. In India, it was considered a good thing. Who decided to just leave the poor folk out? And did they ever articulate that as what they were doing?
It wasn't publicly articulated. There was always a veneer of a sense of broader state socialism. Even when experts who were trained at MIT, who were trained at Johns Hopkins University, or who went to Moscow to get trained, because India played very fair between the two edges of the Cold War, as you can imagine.
Right.
So India was playing both sides. The cover really was that you did think at some point that you needed to invest. But the question was, would you invest from below in terms of community health movements and primary health movements, or would you simultaneously make this infrastructure of tertiary care? There was an illusion that technoscience was really important. It was very important to be able to do open heart surgery 6 months after it happens in the US. It was important to catch up with the West. And I think catching up with the West meant an import of technology to show resilience in your own technology. But it also meant that things that didn't seem to immediately yield something very glamorous or things that would immediately not have results, such as good solid public health at the primary level were things that really were invested in some states, but they were very unevenly distributed across India.
So somewhere in the system of the culture or the history, there is a built-in default to neglect. I wonder if you'd address the sort of moral side of pandemics and this one, and the immoral calculations involved.
The big moral issue with COVID especially is really the accountability of experts and politicians. Mm. We give a huge amount of power to experts, and yet there's a certain moral accountability, which I think falls by the wayside. They're allowed in many ways to go from crisis to crisis. They're the people who bring a history of experiences. They've been part of handling HIV/AIDS crises in India, breakouts of encephalitis that have happened in northern India. Mm. Many of them have had the experiences of seeing various other viral outbreaks in South India. And I feel these are the people who should have really stepped in. And we really also need to ask, how can we make them accountable in terms of the knowledge that they had, the data that they had, and how far they were able to translate that science into political assertiveness?
Make the connections between US and India in these underlying calculations.
For India, we've drifted into making certain choices which are very similar to that in the US. I mean, the lack of oxygen. This is an industrialized country that easily could have, if it had had the right kinds of planning, be able to produce both industrial as well as medical oxygen. So what we see in India is really what we saw a year ago in New York City with the lack of PPE, with the lack of masks. So I see a huge amount of similarity in a system that's fragmented, which is often at various scales, asymmetric to each other. Local needs are often not understood at a state level. And the central administration often doesn't cooperate or is motivated based on the federal or the central administration bases itself really on political parties, on certain kinds of favoritism that exists in states that are supported by that political party. So you see a mechanism where public health has been fragmented not simply by politics, but also by, I think, a lack of reconciliation of understanding what is the big driving interest of public health. Are we looking at being able to reach everyone, or are we simply making this a question of who can afford care or not? And I think somewhere in the 1980s and 1990s, India also turned, partly at the behest of the World Bank, partly at the behest of its own political and social elite, to be able to reconcile that, to see the American model in some ways of the privatization of care, the use of very impressive technoscience as a model that it would like.
Well, in both places, it seems to me, and listening especially on New Delhi, you'd say access to care is the top issue.
Yeah. But to me, what really strikes me, Chris, is the lack of responsiveness and the disconnectedness of officials who feel that when the public don't have this kind of access to care, they've offered access to care, which is often means-tested to the poorest of poor. If they're in a state of emergency, you can just come in. But it's very much like the history of charitable hospitals in New York City, for instance, when there was a stepping aside and gradually the working class didn't get access to the sorts of infectious disease care that they would under older forms of capitalism. And what you have is really a system where everyone reaches the emergency room in New York City. I've seen that when I work in the Columbia University Medical Center. And I can see that equally today now when we look at Delhi, right?
Kavita, when you look at India today, the first round success, second round catastrophe, what do you take to be the political logic in Prime Minister Modi?
I think the political logic has been one of prioritizing politics over the interests of a public and deciding in some ways that you could actually palm off the responsibility to the state level or to the local level. And that's why you have this utter confusion with political party spokesmen representing Prime Minister Modi being able to say that it's not our responsibility. And that's what I was talking about when I spoke about the politics of disconnectedness. In Modi's logic, which has prioritized an offer of economic shift and economic mobility. But you have to understand that health and economic mobility and public health access are not separate. They're two sides of the same coin. Mm. That's really the key, that Modi's vision didn't see this combination, that the economy and mobility and what it offered the middle classes, what it offered the public, apart from Hindu nationalism, is something that wasn't linked to understanding that public health wouldn't align itself with affluence. That's something we have to remember, otherwise it leaves everyone bowling alone. And that's a connection I would make with the US as well. It's the bonds of social solidarity of understanding that welfare and health aren't to be taken for granted the moment you have affluence, which I think in both societies were taken for granted. But I think what this pandemic has shown is that scarcity and suffering comes together even if you're economically affluent and even if you have social capital and social networks.
I want you to go over that again because I think it may be the heart of your argument. The notion being build up a prosperous private economy and consumerism and spending and earning of all sorts. In a three-income family, they should have no problem paying for private transportation, private education, private health care. But then what happens? Why don't they find it, especially in health care?
It's families and communities that have felt that they're prosperous, they're able to spend enough money on consumer durables. They've really found that access to healthcare has been limited because you have a few super specialty hospitals. You don't have really access at every level. You have people from various parts of the world who are coming into super specialty hospitals that offer certain kinds of care, whether it's hip surgeries, whether it's knee replacements to be able to do cardiac surgeries that are specialized. But money, simply access in families to spending, hasn't meant that the healthcare infrastructure has been adjusted to be able to offer access to infectious disease treatment. And that's really the key. These big private hospitals aren't interested in treating infectious diseases. They are interested in treating stuff that they can bill through private insurance that's expensive and that gives them sufficient returns. And that's why they've not had a buildup of wards, of access to be able to deal with COVID itself. I think they saw it coming. But why would a private hospital do that, Chris, when the state itself has stepped away from putting pressure on them to do it? And I think that's really fundamental when we look at neoliberalism and health in India, which is that the state allowed society to privatize, but there was no capacity for oversight to be able to measure, manage, to evaluate the performance of these private actors. So where are people supposed to go? Even when you have a Honda Accord at home, you have washing machines at home, you have three incomes at home, but you lack oxygen.
It sounds so much like our own sort of cathedral hospitals with all kinds of exotic, brilliant surgeries going on, but so many people excluded.
And it's that exclusion which I think is key, Chris. People believe that if you earn enough, you could enter that magic circle of being included and to have certain kinds of care and access. But I don't think they recognize that when the infrastructure itself is lacking, even if you're a strong consumer, you will continue to be excluded. And my real fear is that when this middle class tides over the second wave, that is when the real kinds of neoliberal exclusion that you're talking about will kick in. It happened with HIV/AIDS, for instance, in the US. Once an affluent population consisting mostly of white population that suffered from HIV/AIDS stopped being the population that was witnessing the highest rates of mortality and morbidity, once HIV/AIDS began to be associated with African Americans and a Latino population, what you see is a pandemic that gets largely forgotten or marginalized. And neoliberal exclusion is far more nuanced than we understand it. It's not just in your face. It's the middle classes discovering they've been marginalized now. But when this pandemic comes back season after season, year after year, you'll see that it intersects not only with infections, it intersects with people who have poor nutrition. It affects people who have poor lungs because they've been exposed to the pollution in Delhi or have other chronic diseases. You'll see the most vulnerable and marginalized left with this pandemic that's returning or who don't have access to vaccines. And you'll see exclusion really play out in very different ways, even after the second wave. So we have to see it as something that we need to recognize as being important, much beyond the SOS calls that middle-class Indians are making today.
You want to hold the experts to account, which makes a whole lot of sense. Who's going to hold the systems to account to see broadly what the economic rules are doing to our kids, our grandchildren, our population in general?
I think we underestimate the huge amount of discontent we see voiced now socially, even when the media in many ways has been suppressed in various corners of India. I feel that we will see civic and citizen resistance, and that's happened in several waves. And I think people will ask for and demand in some ways that the state respond and offer certain kinds of social facilities.
Like what?
I mean, I think there will certainly be a demand increasingly to understand what is the access to health, for instance, that people will have. You have voluntary health movements in various places. You have civic organizations that have stepped in. I mean, the state has really stepped out. I'm pessimistic about the state, but I'm very optimistic about the public and its networks.
Sum it up. For Americans particularly, what are the actionable lessons coming out of this Indian catastrophe?
I think the actionable lessons, Chris, are that we all pretend when we are sitting away from the theater of the second or the first wave that it's not going to hit us. And I think India watched that happen when I've had relatives phone me when we were going through the wave in New York City, offering me empathy and sympathy here. India had a conflict between the political messaging that was going on and the public health messaging that was happening simultaneously. The political message was, let's do political rallies. It's all right to have big gatherings. The public health message was, of course, wear your mask, be safe, keep social distancing. But tell me, when this kind of a contradiction occurs, what do we listen to? And we've seen that in the recent past in the US as well. I think we really can't let our guard down. Simply being vaccinated is really one step forward, but it could be several steps back, as we've seen in India, which didn't vaccinate widely and has been left with the situation we see today.
We learn too slowly, but we're learning. Dr. Siva Ramakrishnan, thank you enormously for dedicating still a short lifetime so far to an enormously urgent issue.
Thank you for having me, and particularly for doing a show like this at a moment when all of us feel so deeply disturbed about what's happening in India.
Coming up, how modern India privatized healthcare. This is Open Source. Keshava Guha is a novelist and journalist raised in high-tech Bangalore, the son of India's most famous contemporary historian, Ram Guha. I asked Keshava this week about the dilemmas of privilege in a country revived in the last century by Gandhi's massive marches and popular engagement.
This crisis is different. I mean, one of the assumptions that was made, let's say, by people like us before this crisis was, whatever happens to India, we'll be fine. It's the privilege is a kind of an airbag that kicks in when you're in an accident. You'll be fine even if others are hurt. This time is different. I mean, in Delhi it's worse, but even in Bangalore, you know, people we know aren't able to get hospital beds, for example. Hmm. Basically, anybody short of the billionaire class, they don't know if they'll get a hospital bed. Doctors at elite hospitals can't get their own families admitted. The most expensive and successful hospital in the country, where the place where politicians are typically treated, Medanta, in just outside Delhi, they've run out of oxygen, and today they're not admitting patients. So this is, in a sense, the reason people look to parallels like partition is it's the first time that absolutely everybody, short of the prime minister and the 0.01%, is being touched. I personally know at least 100 people who currently have it. And usually that means in a whole family.
Keshava, I read you online. This is what you said. What are some of the fastest growing industries in urban India? Private healthcare, private education, private security, private electricity generation, private transportation, and private drinking water. India's elite have withdrawn wholesale from the public realm. They have no stake in the provision of most public goods. That didn't happen overnight, and you can't blame that on COVID.
You can't. Now, I think it's very important here to, because I can see your listeners looking for a parallel with the US and the way in which, say, the New Deal and then the Great Society was followed by deregulation, you know, the attack on the welfare state under Reagan and then the New Democrats and all of that. The Indian story is very different, because in many of these cases, actually, the Indian state never provided these things. So whether it's electricity generation, whether it's roads, whether it's actually security, and certainly whether it's health and education, even in the socialist heyday of Nehru and Indira Gandhi, we never managed to provide this. For example, if you compare India to the communist world countries like China, Vietnam, Cuba, yes, India was a democracy. India was largely peaceful, but India was not able to emulate those countries in terms of the provision of basic health and education and infrastructure. So there's no faith in the state. And what we have instead is a kind of free-for-all where if you can afford it, you don't trust the state. We don't think these are public goods of universal value and universal interest. You think that your only question is, can I get my child into a private school? Can I get a hospital bed? Not, am I entitled to it? Is this as a human being? And are all of us entitled to it?
The distant puzzle is, how did that happen in a country that came to be through incredible mass marches and demonstrations, huge public involvement, and dedication is in the Gandhi time to the values of village India, open, public, democratic. Was there a turning point?
There are probably three different turning points. The first, and you're right to phrase the question in that way. So if you take the longer view, India's independence, India's constitution didn't come out of nowhere. It was a product of, you know, struggles, debates that had lasted several decades, perhaps you could argue even over a century. And the vast majority of India's founding fathers believed that political independence was insufficient, that India had to not only be self-governing, but actually be fit for self-government to be a just, fair, free society. So they were actually, many of them were equally, if not more, committed to social reform, to the emancipation of women, to fighting the caste system, to eradicating untouchability, and actually to achieving material progress. And Gandhi, of course, embodied this in his sort of multiple careers as a freedom fighter, but also as a social reformer, as an activist. Gandhi famously said that he hoped that after independence, that Congress would cease to be a political party and would actually become a sort of Gandhian-style social movement, a social reform organization. That didn't happen. But this idea that India needed to not just be a self-governing state, but actually a kind of project of freedom, justice, equality, that was abandoned along the way. And it has to be said that one of the people guilty of that was our, in many ways, great first Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru, who I think both health, the public provision of health and the public provision of education were very curiously blind spots for him. In many ways, he set the template for what followed.
Set the template how, Keshava?
In the sense that the Indian state was concerned with capital goods, with industry, with steel, with building up defense capabilities, nuclear capabilities, even with universities, but not with ensuring the provision of primary health care and primary education. That has been a priority for no government. As a result, voters haven't expected it. So one of the curious facts about India is that governments that don't deliver on health and education face no political penalty because voters don't expect this of the state. No incumbent ever lost re-election in India because the public schools were not well run.
That was Keshava Guha in Bangalore. Vikram Patel has the last word this hour. He's a go-to authority on global mental health. He's a psychiatrist who wrote a manual in 15 languages for places where there is no psychiatrist. He's a senior member of the Public Health Foundation in India, also professor of public health at Harvard Medical School.
I think the most important lesson, Chris, is that we should never believe in our own exceptionalism, that we are somehow unique or different from all other people around the planet.
We Indians, we Americans?
Well, exactly so. Well, you know, let's just turn to the tragedy unfolding in India right now. There was a sense of exceptionalism that India, unlike every other country in the world, would only have one wave of the epidemic. We let our guard down far too quickly and, in fact, even worse, threw fuel on the fire by permitting enormous gatherings of people for religious festivals and for the elections that I believe is one of the major drivers for the catastrophic second wave that the country is witnessing. People are dying not because the virus is killing them, but because they can't get good quality supportive care. You know, Chris, right from the beginning of the pandemic, so much of the emphasis in our conversations in the US and in India have been around high-tech medicine, hospital-based care, intensive care, ventilators, when in fact the majority of people in India who are dying right now are dying not because they can't access the ventilator, but because they can't access low-cost supportive care, which could be delivered by a non-physician, and that basically involves oxygen that could be delivered in even a home-based setting. We missed, in fact, the truth that the overwhelming majority of people who get ill with COVID, in fact, don't need a physician or a hospital. They need good quality nursing.
You're saying something important about low-cost, hand-delivered services. Explain just what you mean.
Well, for example, we know that the vast majority of people with COVID can be managed at home through, well, first of all, by educating people about what they shouldn't be doing. For example, there is a panic-driven rush for remdesivir and other very sophisticated medicines, which actually should only be used by very select groups of people who are admitted to hospital with respiratory distress. So, you know, giving people information about the asymptomatic nature of this condition and the fact that the overwhelming majority of people need nothing more than just to stay at home and to quarantine themselves so they don't infect others. Secondly, when people do develop respiratory problems, we also know that nurse or frontline worker, community health worker supported oxygen therapy at home is the best thing to do. Do not rush to hospital, not only because hospitals are overcrowded, but because actually you're infected and you don't want to be actually moving out of the home unless you actually develop significant respiratory problems. There are very low cost devices that you can use to monitor your oxygen levels, and you can therefore see exactly how well you're doing and only go to hospital when you actually drop below a certain level. Now, that what I've summarized is in a nutshell what we should be disseminating.
This sounds like the Amartya Sen rule about famines. And everybody sort of knows it by now, that famines are not caused by a shortage of food, but by the politics of distribution, the politics of privilege.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, if you look at the three worst affected countries in the world, Chris, Brazil, the U.S., of course, until the early part of this year, the U.S. was the epicenter of the epidemic. And let's not forget that. And, of course, now India joins that club, a kind of country club that no one wants to be a member of. You know, it's not, you know, a coincidence that all three countries are led by men who share very similar characteristics. You know, I'm sure when history is written, it'll turn out that the leadership of a country probably was the single most important determinant of the impact of the epidemic as compared to any other medical or public health intervention.
Individuals at the top.
Well, of course, because this is a national crisis, and what you need is strong leadership, but not just strong in terms of being authoritative, but also strong in terms of having humility to listen to scientists, for example, to recognize that, in fact, we do need to learn from history and from other countries. For example, let's take history. How often has anyone in India sat back and remembered the epidemic of influenza 100 years ago that killed more than 10 million Indians?
Yeah, some say 20 million.
Well, 20 million Indians, but most of those deaths happened in the second wave, not the first wave. It's incredible. What we're seeing right now, in some ways, is almost a facsimile of what happened 100 years ago.
Explain.
100 years ago, we had a new coronavirus that hit Indian shores. It came from Europe. It came because the soldiers who were returning from World War I, you had the first wave of the epidemic, which killed a large number of Indians, but it was a fraction of those who were killed in the second wave. And in both, and on that occasion, as on this one, the country was completely unprepared. Of course, in those days, the country was ruled by Britain. And so at least you could blame the colonists for having completely ignored Indian lives. Today, who do you blame? You blame a democratically elected Indian government.
The more you speak, Vikram, the more Brazil, United States, and India look astonishingly alike. In Trump time, I'm thinking, but very, very large, diverse countries, polarized, in love with performance politics and a certain disdain for science, and this is what we get. Is that fair?
I think so. You know, I mean, I'm a psychiatrist and I'm not going to comment on anyone's personality here. Other people have done that with much more ease because they're freed of the ethical obligations that we have as mental health professionals. But yes, there is something inescapably similar of the three leaders who you just referred to in terms of all the characteristics you mentioned, the belief that one knows the answers to all the problems, including ones one has never encountered before, and that scientists are just a troublesome pests who one should maybe at best, you know, tolerate.
So what do we in Biden time learn and apply from this disaster in India?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, can I just acknowledge that, you know, the transformation in leadership speaks for itself. The fact that today we are in a country where we are looking at a summer with hope, where we can even begin to return to a semblance of what life used to look like, is without any doubt, in part, the hope that we feel because we have a leader in the White House who is willing to listen to people, including, of course, the science community. And so I think this is a very important, a vivid example of how just the man on the top or the woman on the top, one day I hope, actually can influence the way a country perceives the crisis that is at hand. I think what I would say for the US is that I worry, to be honest, whether part of this wave that we're seeing in India is because of the mutation of the virus into a form that is not only very much more infectious than the first wave, but what I worry about is whether it would be as responsive to the immunity that the vaccines that would believe, you know, let's remember those vaccines we're using right now were developed during the first wave. The scientific foundation of those vaccines is based on the genomic structure of a virus that was, as it were, the parent of the one that we are currently seeing in India.
Right.
One prays and hopes that these vaccines are sufficiently broad spectrum and will cover the new variant. But, we don't know for sure if it does. And until we do, clearly, we need to be very cautious in this country as well.
What does it mean that India, which manufactures vaccines, has run out of them, and the ones they're using don't seem to have taken hold? Something like 2% of the country has had the double shot.
Yeah, well, let's be honest. India is not just the vaccine manufacturer of the world. It's also the doctor and nurse manufacturer of the world. You know, there are more doctors of Indian origin in certain specialties working in the US than in India. So I think, to be honest, the real tragedy in India right now is the deep fragmentation of the health sector. The biggest fragmentation really is between the private and public sectors. There is virtually no dialogue between them. And as a consequence, the incredible resource, the collective resource that we have in India, if you count all the doctors and nurses and all the different pharmaceutical companies and so on, and you said they were all working in a coordinated way for a national mission, I don't believe we would have been short of anything. Large part, this is the failure of universal health coverage. This is, to me, the single most important lesson that emerges from this epidemic, is you can have all the resources, you can have all the doctors, you can have all the money, but if you don't coordinate it around universal health coverage, you will fail. And let me tell you this, this is true of the US as well. Let's be honest, the US has 1,000 times more resources than India, but it still fell on its knees. This is a lesson for both countries, that if there is one thing that should come out of the ashes of this epidemic, is a national commitment for universal health coverage.
Vikram Patel, you're the first psychiatrist we've talked to on this subject, and you've worked in mental health in Africa and India. What kind of a mental health assignment do we have in front of us?
Well, this is, of course, very close to my heart and my work. And I think, there are several ways one could discuss this, but I'll just summarize in a couple of big ticket issues. The first is the overall impact, the economic impact that this this pandemic is having on low-income populations in all countries. I was so relieved to hear about the Biden administration's transformative stimulus bill, because it is an evidence-based bill in the sense that we know that immediate cash transfers to low-income communities not only enables them to get back on their feet economically, but actually is also a very powerful intervention for promoting their mental health and preventing depression and suicide. Secondly, I think we must recognize people with existing mental illnesses, both before the pandemic, but also as a consequence of the pandemic, deserve high quality care for their mental health problems. And to do that, we need to deploy low cost solutions, such as the kind of work that I've been doing, which is around using community health workers to deliver low intensity psychosocial interventions. And finally, in India right now, I believe that there is a collective trauma. There is trauma across the country as 1.4 billion people witnessed the state collapsing, not just in terms of the number of deaths that are occurring, but, we all rely on the comfort of knowing there is a government that understands and knows what is going on. And I believe that comfort has been deeply fractured. I believe that in the longer term, to heal the trauma that we see in India, we need a commission that is going to hold a truth and accountability commission, really, to uncover the truth, the facts. And this is not about holding people responsible or blaming people. It's really about, healing this collective trauma through building trust again between the people and the state.
Vikram Patel, this is tough, smart talk, and somehow very encouraging. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks also to Abhinandan Sekri Kavita Sivaramakrishnan, and Keshava Guha, and tips of the hat to Ramchandra Guha, Arthur Kleinman, and David Shumway Jones. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from Chris Johnson and Michael Garth. Mary McGrath looks out for our health. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.